This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Today, we're sponsored by Donors Trust, the principled and tax-friendly way to simplify your charitable giving. We'll talk more about them in the middle of the show. Most people have no idea that pinball, yes, pinball was illegal in New York City from the early 40s until 1976, the bicentennial year, when a journalist named Roger Sharp finally won his crusade against the city fathers to free the flippers. The story of that insane ban is the subject of the new movie Pinball, The Man Who Saved the Game, which Richard Brody of The New Yorker called better than all 10 of the Best Picture nominees. The film was written and directed by Austin Bragg and Meredith Bragg, longtime producers at Reason, best known for collaborating with Remy on his massively popular song parodies and for making libertarian versions of Star Trek, Star Wars, Game of Thrones, and other pop culture franchises. I talked with the Bragg brothers about how they came to tell Roger Sharp's story, what goes into making the perfect satire, and the libertarian message of their pinball movie, which is available on video on demand on all major platforms. Here is the Reason interview with Austin and Meredith Bragg. Austin Bragg, Meredith Bragg, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us for the last few years.
Sometimes you just leave the door open and you don't know what wanders in, but it's really hard to get it out. So that's one reason, kids, lock the doors. When your parents aren't home, lock the doors.
This metaphor went downhill quickly.
Yeah, it did. Like a snowball on fire. Pinball, The Man Who Saved the Game. Give me the short summary of the movie.
Sure. It is, it's a biopic about Roger Sharp, who was the man who helped legalize pinball in New York City in 1976 by proving that it was a game of skill and not chance.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's a great movie. Without reservation and without simply because I know you guys, but it looks great and it really captures, bicentennial era New York. And it's amazing because I know you didn't film in New York really, or you filmed upstate, et cetera. But it just, how did you come across this story? And could you tell a little bit about it? I mean, pinball had been prohibited in New York City and Chicago and a bunch of other major places from the 40s until the mid 70s. Like, what was that about?
Well, the early game was a lot different than the modern game. That's the first thing that we should say. There were no flippers in early pinball. It was literally just a plunger that would send the ball into the field, and it was mostly luck as to where you land.
So it's like it's more like pachinko or something.
It's a lot
like that.
Closer to pachinko. Yeah.
And is that the game that was banned?
Yes, that was the game at the time. And by that same token, let's be honest here, it was a cash-only game. There were definitely mafia connections to pinball, mostly in the distribution channels. But they set it up as this is a game of chance. This is ruining the moral fiber of our children, stealing our children's lunch money. And that was the reason behind the bans.
The flippers came in later, but the ban didn't change.
Right.
And I'll just go ahead and say, I suspect if you were to talk to pinball players back in the 30s and 40s, before the invention of the flipper, they would say that there is still some skill because there is, and this still remains as part of the game. You hit the board, you hit it so that the ball goes in certain directions. Right. And that still remains part of the game. So you can't hit it too much or else the game will tilt. But good players know how to hit the machine at the right moment to get the ball to do what they want to do. So it wasn't completely luck.
Sure. And even if it was chance, like what did you win when pinball was banned? Was it like, oh, here are cash prizes or something? Or was it just like, oh, you win a free game? What was...
Depends on who was operating the game. There were games in which you would win... You know, like a sort of an amusement park game, you would win prizes or cash. Eventually, they started creating pinball games where you won free games as part of the game itself.
Like they were hooking you, right?
Right.
You would win a
then
free
they
game.
Changed that.
Part of the game there was that players who are very good could win lots and lots of free games, and then they would basically sell those games back to the operator.
Well, we really dodged a bullet with this pinball ban. That's what I'm hearing. Fiorella LaGuardia is kind of the villain of the piece. If, you know, and that's an overstatement, but yeah, why did LaGuardia ban pinball in LaGuardia, New York City?
Yeah, LaGuardia came in on a definitely on a crusade to stop organized crime, which I think was a laudable goal. But it was very hard to do, and it was very hard to show people that he was succeeding. Removing pinball machines from bars, restaurants, bowling alleys, wherever he found them, was a visual sign that he was doing something about it. And it was a PR campaign. So you have photos, and we recreate one of them in the movie, of LaGuardia pushing over a pinball machine, of smashing pinball machines with sledgehammers.
Setting them on fire.
Literally setting them on fire.
Them off of boats.
Yeah, most
well, they
of
are
the-
pure evil, right?
Right.
I mean, you really got to take them out. Yeah.
So this was to show the public that he was doing something about organized crime.
And the images that are recreated in the movie, I mean, it's kind of like when prohibition agents would go into bars and they, you know, they wouldn't just close the bar. They would roll out the wooden beer kegs and then smash them in the street in front of people. So you saw all the beer running away. And I mean,
exactly.
It's publicity, right?
And you certainly call the press to come with their cameras before you do so.
Yeah, it's a man, you know, that whole canard that, you know, by playing pinball, you were supporting the mob. In that same era in New York, it's like every time you put your garbage out, you were supporting the mob. It is both super effective and so ridiculous. It's, you know, it's kind of perfect. How did you hear about Roger Sharp in this story? Because it's a great story that this, you know, kind of at first freelance journalist for GQ, you know, ended up kind of changing a whole legal regime.
So we're not entirely sure where we first heard about the fact that pinball was illegal. As you know, we work at Reason. We come across these sorts of bizarre
stories a lot. Reason, what is that? I'm sorry, I've never heard.
I'll send you a magazine later. I'll get you a comp. Cool. We have a huge Google Docs list full of bizarre things that we have found, and we occasionally dip back into it. That said, the last short film we did is called A Piece of Cake, and it is about how difficult it is to find those little silver dragees, those little silver confectionery
right.
balls.
They're like BBs. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That you find on Christmas cookies or wedding cakes. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that we Googled illegal silver balls and this popped up, or that photo of Roger popped up, which is just a great photo. I would urge everyone to go take, you know, just type in Roger Sharp pinball shot. You'll see the photo. This guy with this great mustache. Playing
is it great or is it ridiculous?
It's both. That's why it's
great.
In
that shot, it looks super. Anyway,
he's playing pinball with scowling city council members in the city council chambers, proving that the game is that there's skill involved in winning games. That it's not luck. And so it was just around the time that it was before COVID shut things down. But about the time that everyone suspected it was going to be shut down, and I cold emailed Roger. At this point, I wasn't sure whether it was going to be a doc, whether it was anything at all. Vice had done a really good documentary about Roger and his sons, who are competitive pinball players and work in the pinball industry, and that went into the shot and Roger's history. So I knew that he had done some interviews before, and it's a really good doc. So I wasn't sure what we were going to do with it. I got on the phone with him, and about 3 hours later, I hung up and I texted Austin and I said, I think this might be a feature. And the reason is because he told me about all the other things not surrounding the shot, not surrounding pinball.
And the shot is, I mean, there's a climactic moment. I don't think it gives anything away, but where he's got to play pinball in front of the city council or the commission that is going to rule on this. And he's got to kind of hit a particular shot. Otherwise, things might not go his way.
Right. I mean, it all stems from what Roger was telling us and what he's told other outlets about that particular moment where, you know, as soon as he started talking, the chairman kind of was poking him with questions and prodding him about his book and how he might be a shill for the industry, and that he switched the games on him at the last minute because he thought that the game might be rigged. I mean, it was pretty clear that this chairman was out to get Roger. And in the very end, it's all about that one little light on the machine that he hasn't hit yet, that he has to get for that final shot to convince him.
But he ended up telling us not just like that story is well known.
Right.
And you can, especially in the pinball community, but you can go learn all about it. But what he told me over the phone was about meeting a single mother and starting a relationship with her, his time at GQ, his backstory. And that made it more universal. There were a lot, it was a lot more than just essentially a sports movie about one person making a particular shot. It became something bigger, I think.
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's a clear libertarian kind of message to the broad story, which is, you know, it features an insane prohibition on an activity that, you know, people want to do, and which was also legal, like across the Hudson River in New Jersey and things like that. So it's like totally arbitrary. But there is this broader question. Can you, or this broader appeal, can you talk a little bit about the ideology behind the movie? Like, is there a message? This is not a message movie. That, you know, you're not sending a telegram. But, you know, what is the kind of libertarian contour to it? And then what is the larger kind of message that you hope people take?
I think the larger sort of theme that we keep hammering back to is this idea of risk. And how people should be allowed to set their own levels of risk. And that if you're trying to keep things safe and trying to keep people under control, it's harder to get anything accomplished, right? I mean, we literally come out and say life is defined by risk, those that you take and those that you don't.
And I think it's about giving people choice, which is very big in, you know, at Reason and for libertarians. The idea of allowing people to take these risks, choice, and finding their own happiness in a niche environment that maybe other people don't understand, but that's okay.
Yeah,
he's not hurting anyone by playing pinball, and yet the place that he found in the city. Yeah. Got raided, and that's how it all started. That's what kicked off his journey.
I mean, that's part of the early part. Like, pinball is illegal in New York City, but there are still machines around. But like, he goes to a peep show in Times Square. So is that's where, I mean, in the name of preserving, you know, the sanctity of childhood and whatnot, basically the prohibition on pinball moves it into kind of, you know, seamier and seamier subcultures.
Precisely. Yeah. He found it in an adult bookstore, on the front entrance of an adult bookstore. The other place he ended up finding pinball, which we don't get into in the movie, but in real life is a head shop. So that's a perfect example. And it's one of these things where he didn't quite know why he was having a hard time finding pinball. He just, you know, he had come from the University of Wisconsin, right? Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he, there was pinball all over the place. And then he comes to New York and it's nowhere. He happens to come across it and he doesn't think twice about it until it gets raided. And that's what sets him off.
I really like the notion of, you know, that this is a, you know, it's a subculture or a community that maybe a lot of people don't know about and they don't care about, but you kind of show on the fly of how pinball is, you know, is this amazing amalgam of technology and artistry, because the machines themselves are really complicated. And anybody who has been in an arcade, when they flip open the machine to work on it, I mean, it's like a tangle of wires and lights and all of this, but the design is really intricate. And the artwork, I think, has, you know, come in for, you know, acclaim and things like that. But it is the type of thing that, you know, that urge to stamp out something you don't understand or you don't see any conceivable reason for, that is kind of still with us, isn't it?
Always. right? We're always on the verge of trying to ban video games or D&D or rock music. I mean, this is always at the forefront of these culture wars.
The novel, dancing. Yeah.
Well, you know, dancing is, that's risky. I mean, that's,
we can
science,
understand that.
Science
sure.
has shown us that that's risky. How long did it take? It's a committee or a commission on gambling, or what was the group that he had to demonstrate to that this is not simply luck, that this is a game of skill?
It was the Consumer Affairs Commission that had this bill that was first proposed, and then they would take it to the General Assembly. So he was in front of the Consumer Affairs Commission when he took the shot.
And how long after, you know, kind of he convinced that commission or committee, how quickly did things change?
Within months?
It was a few months, yeah. Yeah. I know that the mayor signed the bill on his birthday, mm-hmm. which is not something we got to get in the movie, but I'm glad I could get it out here because it's kind of fun.
Yeah. Can I ask, I mean, because one of the things that it is a biopic and it has this message, but it's not a message movie. One of the things that you do, which is, I think, really helpful, is that you have an actor playing Roger who's kind of telling the story. How did you think about organizing this material? Because you could go in a million different directions. How did that happen?
I think a lot of it just stems from the way this project came to be, right? During the pandemic, we ended up on these Zoom calls with Roger while everything is in lockdown. So we spent cumulatively days interviewing Roger about his life, his times. And, you know, we got to know him really well. We became good friends and we're giving each other hard times as we go. And I literally told him at one point, Roger, I'm going to open this movie with you saying, I don't know why you want to make this a movie. Mm-hmm. And I think from that, we came up with this idea of there being two Rogers, right? Roger from the 70s and then Mr. Sharp, as we called him, which allows us to take this story from his perspective, which, you know, partly explains the sanitized nature of it. This is the cleanest 70s New York City you'll ever see. And the most G-rated adult bookstore in existence. And it allowed us to have some push and pull, just like we were having with Roger, about, you know, the script and the direction for this to go in.
Why did Chicago, which, as you guys point out, Chicago was the industrial heartland of pinball, but it banned pinball as well. You know, was that just, again, an attempt to stamp out organized crime and look good doing it? Or it just seems so bizarre.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that took place all over the country.
And some of, you know, in the film, we have a section where, you know, Roger creates what becomes essentially the first book about mm-hmm. pinball. And in the pinball community, it's a well-known book. He does this by going and interviewing people, including the folks that were running the pinball games that actually create, you know, had the factories.
And so these are people at like Bally and Midway right. and all of the best known Gottlieb or right. whatever it is. Yeah.
And he had audio tapes. He recorded all these and he had many of the audio tapes that he had digitized and he sent them to us. So a lot of what these people are saying comes directly from, I mean, the phrasing comes directly from these audio tapes. And they may talk about this all the time. You know, there's too much attention on this industry. Chicago was always making headlines and not the good kind.
Right.
So it just became a focal point for the mob and people who were interested in taking down organized crime and the mob. And this was one way to do it.
Yeah. And it worked, right? Because from the mid-40s until the mid-70s, the mob really, we didn't hear anything about them.
There was no crime at all.
Yeah. You know, well, it was a bottom-up crime. So we kind of like that, right? Small-time, you know, Hayekian organized crime, I guess.
Sure, sure.
The 70s, that milieu, were you guys even alive in the 70s?
Technically, yes.
Yeah, technically we were alive, but we don't remember anything.
So it's kind of like right now, actually.
Precisely right now. Mm-hmm. Yes.
But, you know, there's this moment, and, you know, as somebody who was in the New York area in the 70s, you know, New York was in its nadir. This is the era of, Ford to New York, Drop Dead, all of that kind of stuff. Is there part of the message that social change or you know, political change happens when things have really gone off the rails? Like if New York was flourishing, you know, 10 years later or 20 years later, do you think pinball, the prohibition on pinball would have been repealed? Or it's just kind of like government had shown itself to be completely incapable of governing the city or of doing anything right. And it becomes easier for people to be like, no, let's try something different.
I think the fact that New York was in such bad shape helped fuel Rogers' indignation that they were going after pinball. I don't think it's necessary for the city to be going down the drain in order to actually get any change on this front, because we've seen it happen all over the country over the decades after the Roger helped legalize it in New York City.
That said, they did monetize the legalization. Mm-hmm. They were granting license fees, and yep, there was a promise with this legalization bill that they would be getting a lot more money into the city coffers.
Did that work out? Do you know? Or
No.
Yeah. And was it earmarked for children and old people? Because that's sure. What legalized gambling, which came to Atlantic City a couple of years after this, was, you know, supposed to solve all our cures. So
sure.
Or serve, cure all our ills. Do either of you play pinball? Do you have, a particular...
Badly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we learned how to play pinball really badly from we came from nothing. We are not pinball players.
Yeah.
But when you realize that you're going to be writing and then directing this movie, you feel the need to learn.
So you're not hitting both flippers at the same time, like I was going to use a slur, I guess, but like a bad pinball player.
Not anymore. No.
Yeah, all not right. anymore. But we're not good.
No, not we're, by any
means. Is the pinball industry? I mean, it's also part of what's. I mean, there are many elements of this which you can like kind of focus on and luxuriate in because it seems distant. But is the pinball industry in a good place or a bad place with the, you know, I mean, in the intervening decades, it seems like everything is video games or video related. Is pinball coming back as like an artisanal sport or something?
Yeah, I have that feeling that pinball always seems to be either in a great resurgence or on its last legs at any given moment. And it seems like right now we're on an upswing. There are certainly fewer manufacturers than there used to be, but there also seems to be a larger group of collectors out there. It's kind of amazing how many pinheads come out of the woodwork when you're working on a project like this and you talk to people about it and they go, wait a minute, I have three in my basement.
Yeah.
When you think, okay.
I think we should probably hat tip Roger Sharp here too, because certainly. He was an executive producer on this. Mm-hmm. He helped identify and gather all the vintage pinball machines that were used. And that comes from both, I think, a deep appreciation in the pinball community for what Roger's done, not just here, but also he worked in the pinball industry after this for decades. He's been involved, but also just that this community is so tight. And when Roger calls and says, hey, can you get me this machine in a couple days? I need it in Newburgh, New York.
Which is where most of the shooting took place, right? In Newburgh.
Correct.
It's upstate New York.
We had one machine, for whatever reason, was going to be a scratch. And Roger got on the phone and I think had it by the morning. Yeah. I think, 12, 16 hours later, we had a rare 70s machine in front of us.
This, there's a romance, all of which is based in reality and whatnot. And you guys kind of very smartly in the movie suss out, you know, what's Hollywoodized and what was real, all of that. But could you just, what did Roger Sharp do after, you know, after taking the shot and kind of helping to overturn the pinball prohibition in New York and hence the country?
He finished his book, for one. Roger and James Hamilton have what we were speaking of before, the sort of original book of pinball, which is fantastic and hard to find now, but there are editions out there. He worked in the industry designing games, and I feel like for the more significant portion of his time, he was in the marketing side.
Licensing
side, pardon me. And marketing. He did some marketing as well. If it's pinball related, Rogers probably had some hands in it somewhere.
Let's talk about your body of work at Reason. Meredith, you joined Reason staff first. What year did you join?
2009, 2010, okay. Something like that.
Okay, so that's early. Austin, what about you?
I've joined Reason twice. Is that,
yeah, that's
so
right.
So my first
the
time
third time is
been...
the charm, by the way. That's when you actually convert. But.
Fair. I think the first time would have been not long after you arrived. So that would have been 2010, 2011, maybe? Mm-hmm. 2010, I think.
All right. So, I mean, you guys have been here for like a dozen years plus. You're best known for your, I mean, you both made documentaries and, you know, and kind of serious videos for us, but you're best known for comedy videos. You are principal collaborators with Remy and doing the song parodies. Can you talk a little bit about what goes into that kind of collaboration and what's a good song parody versus a so-so or a bad song parody?
Good versus bad, that so often comes down to Remy himself. I can't tell you the number of times that Remy has sort of submitted a pitch to us, and I thought, oh, a Remy original, and it's not. It's music I've just never heard of before. That has millions and millions of views on YouTube. I'm not tuned in. Usually Remy will come with a pitch, and then we'll go through and talk about that. We'll talk about the visuals. We'll talk about the original song, what will actually be, you know, what are the parody elements of it. You know, we'll try to punch it up where we can, but a lot of the fun and a lot of the experimentation will happen when we're shooting.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, all right. There's enough of that.
Okay. Is it, you know, are the most successful song parodies, is it because of the song is well known or because the issue that's being made fun of is well known? Or is it some kind of alchemy of both?
I think it's a dark art alchemy of both. You never quite sure. You can have very, sometimes I've been surprised at what's hit mm-hmm. and what hasn't. Mm-hmm. I think we've all had that experience where, you know, we put out a video and we think it's great and it just doesn't do the numbers. And then other videos we think are fine. Like we don't put out trash, but we try, you know, some things we put out and we're like, yeah, this is fine. It's a single, it's a double. And it ends up being a home run. One thing we have found out is that the thumbnail is incredibly important. And if you can some way, shape or form, take the thumbnail associated with the video, the original song, and create a Remy-ized version of it for ours, that seems to help. And I think that's one of the reasons that the banana song mm-hmm. did so well is right. that it was a very easy lift from the original album cover to the Remy thumbnail.
Do you have a favorite Remy parody or Remy video that you guys have worked on?
There are a few I really like.
I mean, it's that first Raise the Debt Ceiling will always have a soft spot in my heart. But there have been so many.
Which has
fun
been
ones.
Seen by millions and millions of people. I mean, it's like the cosmos of Remy videos. And it's not clear what it means, is it?
And I think that the one that we did, I think you edited it, the black and white with the...
Oh, well, Why We Fought?
Fought and Died. I love that one.
Yeah, I think that might be the very first Remy video.
It was, I believe.
Yeah.
It was definitely my first.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. I love it.
It's brilliant. It's a kind of country rockabilly song, and there's three or four different versions of Remy who are singing against one another, and... I remember when, you know, that Remy first started collaborating with us, it was like, wow, this is, you know, it's like discovering plutonium or something, because it was so funny. Technically, it looked great. And the message was, you know, really deep and dark and wonderful. And I still kind of am mad that that's not like the biggest Remy of all time, because it's really fantastic.
I mean, there's always an argument for another Remy being the best of all time.
Yeah,
anytime for sure. You've got his TSA agent with the pencil-thin mustache creepily waggling his fingers at you.
The TSA does not seem to have the same juice as it used to. There was a period, when we were doing Reason videos where you could anything with TSA in it would do hundreds of thousands of views, if not more. What do you think happened? Why did the why did that
run dry? It's almost as if we've normalized it.
Yeah,
we've just become numb.
Is there anything that's taken its place? I guess this is a roundabout way of saying, is parody getting harder as we live in a world that is us? You know, on the one hand, culture is not consumed as broadly as it might have been once. There's not like 3 channels, so everybody knows what you're making fun of. But also, the world has just become more and more kind of bizarre.
I think in some ways it's harder because there's not necessarily a shared understanding of the original. It's why I think Remy tends to choose some of the older songs. You know, the Beatles song did particularly well. Mm-hmm. We're working on a Foo Fighters song right now that'll hopefully come out soon by the time this airs, I believe. But that those are well-known songs. But that's also the reason why Remy does originals. And I mean, you know, People Will Die is a perfect example of an original that blew up and I think deserved to.
And it's also fantastic in the sense of like it's an original, but it sounds like, oh, I know that song. So it's kind of playing with our cultural memory. Yeah.
The pitfall of working with Remy is you will be singing whatever song he's parodying for a week after you've released it because you've been listening to it for a week and a half.
Well, we thank you for your service on
thank
that.
Thank you.
Before we continue with the Reason interview with the Bragg brothers, I want to share a message from today's sponsor, Donors Trust. Tax season, I mean, you know this, it's upon us. You're probably digging up receipts from one-time donations you made throughout 2022. Maybe you're kicking yourself for not simplifying your philanthropy and dumping a chunk of tax-advantaged change into a Donors Trust giving account. A giving account makes a world of difference when filing your taxes. You can contribute to a Donors Trust giving account, take the tax break, and let them do the paperwork every time you want to make a gift to your favorite charities in the Liberty Movement. Giving accounts are simple, secure, and tax advantaged. It's really, really easy. You can think of Donors Trust wistfully while pulling your hair out during taxes. Or you can open a simple, secure, tax advantage giving account and make tax day that much easier on yourself. There's an added bonus. When you open an account with Donors Trust, you become part of a community of like-minded givers that honor and share your belief in free markets and limited government. So don't wait any longer. Visit donorstrust.org/Nick. Donors Trust, DonorsTrust. .org/Nick. Get a free donor prospectus and learn more about Donors Trust. Just one last time, www.donorstrust.org/Nick. And now back to the Reason interview with the Bragg brothers. The other, kind of ongoing loose series of videos that I think you guys are particularly well known for are the libertarian takes on various things like Star Wars, Star Trek, Game of Thrones. What's the secret sauce there?
Time. I mean, truly, you need something that is insanely popular, right? Which you don't always have. But something that has just an enormous fandom like that is super helpful. The more footage you have, the better. So something like Star Wars or Star Trek or even Game of Thrones with how many seasons it has gives you more fodder to play with. And then it's just about time. It's about going through it and looking for every opportunity to take a libertarian angle on something. Whittling all those opportunities down to only the best bits and then getting it on its feet. It's a longer process than most of the other videos that we put out. That's for sure.
What is the, you have a lot of fun at the expense of libertarian beliefs. Where does that come from?
Self-hatred? I mean,
you know, look, to be fair, Austin, it's not just you who hates you. It's everybody around.
What do you think fuels it, Nick?
Yeah.
No, I think it's important that, you know, we're equal opportunity offenders. There's anyone who thinks that their own side is pristine needs to do some soul searching. And I don't think there's – is there anyone within the libertarian sphere right now who – thinks that our side is pristine?
I mean, I think it's also we come from a love of self-deprecating humor. It's how we were raised. You know, we made fun of ourselves and each other around the dinner table, and I think we just naturally bring that anywhere.
It's great. I mean, it really energizes everything that you do. How did you each come to libertarianism? And can you do a quick definition? What's kind of your working definition of being libertarian?
I remember in an early interview, Nick, that I was with you with Penn Jillette, and I remember Penn Jillette. You asked him this question, and he said, essentially, I don't believe that I or anyone else has the right answers for other people about how to live their life, and that resonates pretty strongly with me. Mm-hmm. I've been involved in a number of sort of subcultures, DIY groups. And I knew that what I enjoyed was not mainstream. And I didn't want other, and that I think instilled in me this idea that we should allow, again, I'm going to steal another phrase. If you didn't popularize it, someone else at Reason did, of experiments in living and allowing people to flourish, you know, to pursue their own happiness as long as they're not a detriment to someone else doing that, whatever that happiness may be. I think that's pretty much where it comes from, mine at least.
Yeah, I mean, we grew up in a fairly conservative household in a fairly liberal area. So I think it was pretty natural that we ended up somewhere between the two.
Are you optimistic about libertarian thinking, libertarian living, libertarian politics these days? Because, you know, you've been at Reason over, you know, for the past dozen or so years. And, you know, how are you feeling about, you know, the direction of the country? I think the last time I checked, it was, according to Gallup, it was like 23% of the country think the country is going in the right direction. Are you in that, you know, cadre, or are you in the, you know, the other percentage that?
I mean, I could have said no as soon as you said, are you optimistic? So I'm not sure I'm the best barometer for this.
I tend to bring a little bit more optimism, I think, to this, to this relationship. But I'm not short-term optimistic.
Yeah. How did you guys, you work at Reason, but how did you first encounter Reason?
Our older brother, got interested. I think he was, or maybe I was watching C-SPAN with him, shows how exciting we are. I think the Libertarian Convention was on TV or something. We're flipping around. At that point, I sort of knew I wasn't Republican. I knew I wasn't Democrat. I didn't know what I was and just sort of didn't. But also growing up in the DC area, you can't help but take in a little bit of politics and just know what's going on, even if you're not necessarily engaged. And he got interested in it. So for Christmas that year, I went to the Libertarian Party headquarters and bought him a couple books, and then proceeded over to that winter break. He read them and I read them, and I thought I nodded my head a lot. And that was my in. And I think he may have had some Reason magazines. I need to fact check that with him, but I'm pretty sure that he did. So somehow that's how I first learned about Reason. I think it's because he had magazines.
And your older brother is a academic researcher?
He's a doctor.
He's
a successful medical professional.
Wow. Yeah.
Neurologist.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Do you, Meredith, you were deeply involved in, you mentioned the DIY kind of, you know, post-punk music community in DC. And this is the same, you know, kind of scene that gave rise to Minor Threat and Fugazi and a bunch of other bands. Do you it seems to me like if you're DIY, you're essentially libertarian in a real way, because you're going to be helping other people. You're doing things for yourself. You know, is it at all frustrating that you seem to be the only person who came out of that scene who's actually libertarian, as opposed to some kind of progressive lefty?
No, I mean, it's not frustrating. It's not, it's not like we talk politics a lot anyway. No, I mean, it's most of the things that, I was in bands and I had band members who were very far left and others who were sort of non-committal. And we would have interesting conversations, but that's sort of, I've never wanted my politics to come in any sort of confrontation with friendships, if I can help it. Like at least that's never been, maybe other people feel differently when they, talk to me about it, but I've never felt that way. And I think as libertarians, especially, I think we learn to navigate conversations with people that don't agree with us, because frankly, most people don't, at least they don't think they do. And we can always find a common cause against the other side, whatever that other side may be. Mm-hmm. Right. And then debate the issues that we don't, but no, it's never been an issue with me, and I don't think it's been an issue with my friends.
I wanted to ask you about parenting, because you're both parents. And one of the things I've always heard since at least showing up at Reason almost 30 years ago was that, libertarianism has nothing to say about kids or about parenting, or that, everybody's a libertarian until they have kids, et cetera. Austin, can I start with you? Has being a parent thrown into, question your libertarian bona fides, or has that changed how you think about politics or ideology?
No, but I should probably mention that I'm a very bad parent. I think the only real way it changed was, the appropriateness of the onesies that he was given as a child. But no, I don't think that's really changed anything at all for me.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that's a terrible answer.
I mean, it's a good answer. It's first off, it's an honest answer, so that's good. But it's also, maybe this whole canard that libertarianism leaves out an entire essential part of human activity is just wrong. And Meredith, do you have anything to say about that?
I'm sort of with Austin on this. It's not something that I'd ever really heard. It's not something I agree with, for sure. I have two daughters, and we're raising them to, think for themselves. And I remember I got very frustrated with one of my daughters at one point, because she wasn't doing something that I'd asked her to do. And I remember my wife looked at me and said, "Do you want a compliant child?" And I thought, no, I guess I don't. Like, that's not what I want. I'm not.
I do.
Yeah. sometimes I do. Yeah.
It depends on how recently I've read a story about the Menendez brothers that I think that's about. Fair. Compliant kids aren't so bad, but. Are you guys optimistic? Meredith, you said you're not optimistic in the short term, but that implies that you are optimistic in the longer term. How do we get to the longer term if the current moment seems kind of shitty?
I mean, I hold out hope that eventually the partisans on the left and right punch themselves out and people start looking for something else, for an alternative. But frankly, I thought of Trump as a libertarian thought experiment that that happened in the real world, and to show people why maybe we should rein in executive power. Yeah. And that did not work out the way I had intended. So
you intended?
I didn't intend. It was all me.
Yeah, thanks.
You're welcome.
There was that glorious moment after he, was deemed the winner. There were those headlines of maybe giving Obama so much executive power wasn't a good idea. And that lasts about 2 weeks. And then we went back as if that was no longer a discussion. Yeah.
Trump with a drone kill list seemed like a bad idea. And yet what ended up happening is he expanded, just like every president, he expanded executive power. And we will, I'm sure that, you know, both parties will come to regret it, depending
but
on who's
in power.
But
now that we have an old guy with a lot of experience and no reality testing, it's going to be okay,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
always going to be okay if your guy is in office.
Yeah. And your guy is pretty much going to be in office every other term, right? It seems.
Your yeah. guy is the right guy.
Yeah. yeah. Austin, how do you, I mean, are you long-term pessimistic as well as short-term or, you know, and
no,
how do we get from where we are to, you know, where we want to be?
I don't see myself as long-term pessimistic. I just think that long-term is well beyond my lifespan, right? I think about the long arc of civilization and, you know, how things used to be in the Middle Ages. Obviously, we're making progress in the short term, though. It's not like I'm digging out a bunker or, you know, sowing the seeds in my crisis garden at this stage, but it's not like I'm turning on the news with any sort of hope.
Yeah. Do you, as people who have helped pollute the internet with, yep. you know, political videos and comedy videos and
you those know, are the ones you know about.
Yeah. Now, trust me, we've got trackers on you. You know, that's you don't realize it, but when you sign up with Reason, it's like a total surveillance project. You know, going back like a dozen years ago, it seemed, you know, in the early stages or what we now, I guess, recognize as the early stages of online video and whatnot, people were really pretty optimistic about sites like YouTube or platforms like YouTube. And platforms like Twitter and whatnot. Now it seems not so much. Can you kind of, do you share that pessimism or that sense of exhaustion with online culture? Or do you think people have gotten it wrong? Or, you know, how do we shake off this gloom and doom that, you know, the very technology that is allowing us to talk to each other in real time across hundreds of miles with varying degrees of technical wonderfulness, you know, this is like a bad thing.
I mean, part of this, I think, is just a natural evolution of a new technology dominates the culture and the people need to learn how to deal with it, right? That's just, I think that just happens. And if we don't get there, our children will. Like, they'll figure out, they'll balance things. I love YouTube. I use it as an educational resource when I need to fix a sink, when I can't figure out something in After Effects. My kids use it. They watch documentaries on there. It's amazing. It's fantastic. I love being able to listen to any song I want pretty much whenever I want. Podcasting. I'm a big, deep podcast listener. No, I mean, this is, the technology's great. Have I found myself doom scrolling at night for, you know, an hour and put my phone down thinking that was a wasted hour? Absolutely. But I don't fault the technology. That's something I just need to learn how to, you know, I need to learn how to handle it better, basically. But I don't fault the technology, nor would I want to necessarily rein it in. Just because I don't understand TikTok as well as, you know, some of my daughter's friends, doesn't mean that I need to necessarily cancel TikTok. It's not for me, but obviously it's giving joy to a lot of other people.
Is there something you both in a way kind of grew up at the tail end of what might be called a scarcity economy, particularly for things like video or old TV shows, old movies, old songs, like where you couldn't just read about something and then go find it and kind of look at it. Is that a meaningful loss to think about, that, you know, scarcity and that the hunt for the thing that you had read about or heard about? You know, is there any kind of meaningful loss there?
Not for me. No, I mean, to me, there's value in being able to communicate and share and have these resources available to anyone. For, you know, little to no input on their end. Is that driving some of the behavior? I don't know. But no, I don't want to have to search three different Sam Goody's searching for that one cassette tape that I was after.
The problem is you were at Sam Goody. I used to go to record stores and
he's Mr. Cool, right? He's Captain Cool.
I had a lot of friends that I met at record stores because we were both digging in the same bins trying to find something. We would see each other at these small shows, right? That sort of community, and it happened in film too. You'd have these art house theaters and you would end up seeing the same people and talk with them. So yes, I miss that sort of meet space community. But that doesn't mean it's not happening in other places, or that it's maybe even grown virtually, right? You could find more people that share your niche interests very quickly, and you could find a lot more information faster. I suspect it's just misplaced nostalgia on my part, but yeah, I miss a little bit of it.
But
sure.
I mean, there's
I wouldn't give up where we are.
Yeah. And I guess there are ways to recreate the community of necessity in the past of, you know, in a record store, a video store or something like that. I mean, people are doing that.
Yeah, it already exists, right? Yeah. I mean, people are connecting over shared interests on countless platforms right now, mm-hmm. more than ever before. If, you know, I guess the only problem is they're not doing it in physical space.
Or, yeah. And again, that's not necessarily a huge problem. I would not give up the benefits of today just to recreate my own nostalgia of, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. And the more narrow that niche is, the harder it is to find mm-hmm. people in meet space anyway. So no, I'm fully on board.
Let me just ask, can you tell us where we can watch or Pinball, The Man Who Saved the Game?
Yes. MPI Original Films created they're behind Pinball, the movie, and they also did our short film, A Piece of Cake. They created a website called pinballfilm.com. So if you go there, it has all of the updates. The film is set to be released on video on demand on the 17th of March. It may play select theaters as well. We're still waiting to hear where, but there are. It's also playing around the country at some festivals, and some people are bringing it to their town. So absolutely check out the website, mm-hmm. pinballfilm.com, and that's where you can find the latest news and where it's showing.
Austin Bragg, Meredith Bragg, thanks for talking, and thanks especially for Pinball, The Man Who Saved the Game.
Thank you.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please, before you do anything else, go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and sign up there. Maybe leave a review, too. That would be great. It helps us. Or make it easy on yourself and just go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. And while you're at reason.com/podcasts, check out the Reason Roundtable and the SOHO Forum debates. Thanks for listening.